They made a place on the straw for Althuda to sleep near Hal and Daniel so that they could talk quietly in the darkness. "How many of your men are in the mountains?" Hal wanted to know. "There are 19 of us to begin with, but 3 were killed by the Dutch, and 5 others died after we escaped. The mountains are cruel, and there are many wild beasts." "What weapons do they have?" Hal asked. "They have the muskets and the swords that we captured from the Dutch, but there is little powder, and by now it might all be used up. My companions have to hunt to live."
"Surely they have made other weapons?" Hal inquired.
"They have fashioned bows and pikes, but they lack iron points for these weapons."
"How secure are your hiding places in the wilderness?" Hal persisted.
"The mountains are endless. The gorges are a tangled labyrinth. The cliffs are harsh, and there are no paths except those made by the baboons."
"Do the Dutch soldiers venture into these mountains?"
"Never. They dare not scale even the first ravine." These discussions filled all their evenings, as the winter gales came ravening down from the mountain like a pride of lions roaring at the castle walls. The men in the dungeons lay shivering on the straw pallets. Sometimes it was only the talking and the hoping that kept them from succumbing to the cold. Even so, some of the older, weaker convicts sickened. Their throats and chests filled with thick yellow phlegm, their bodies burned up with fever, and they died choking and coughing. The flesh was burned off those who survived. Although they became thin, they were hardened by the cold and the labour. Hal reached his full growth and strength in those terrible months, until he could match Daniel at belaying a rope or hefting the heavy hods. His beard grew out dense and black, and the thick pigtail of his hair hung down between his shoulder blades. The whip marks latticed his back and flanks, and his gaze was hard and relentless when he looked up at the mountain tops, blue in the distance.
"How far is it to the mountains?" he asked Althuda in the darkness of the cell.
10 leagues," Althuda told him.
"So far," Hal whispered. "How did you ever reach them over such a distance, with the Dutch in pursuit?"
"I told you I was a fisherman," Althuda said. "I went out each day to kill seals to feed the other slaves. My boat was small and we were many. It barely served to carry us across False Bay to the foot of the mountains. My sister Sukina does not swim. That is why I would not let her chance the crossing."
"Where is that boat now?"
"The Dutch, who pursued us, found where we had hidden it. They burned it." Each night these councils were short-lived, for they were all being driven to the limit of their strength and endurance. But gradually, Hal was able to milk from Althuda every detail that might be of use.
"What is the spirit of the men you took with you to the mountains?"
"They are brave men, and women too, for there are 3 girls with the band. Had they been less brave, they would never have left the safety of their captivity. But they are not warriors, except one."
"Who is he, this one amongst them?"
"His name is Saba. He was a soldier until the Dutch captured him. Now he is a soldier again."
"Could we send word to him?"
Althuda laughed bitterly. "We could shout from the top of the castle walls or rattle our chains. He might hear us on his mountain top."
"If I had wanted a jester, I would have called on Daniel here to amuse me. His jokes would make a dog wretch, but they are funnier than yours. Answer me now, Althuda. Is there no way to reach Saba?"
Though his tone was light, it had an edge of steel to it, and Althuda thought a while before he replied. "When I escaped, I arranged with Sukina a hiding place beyond the bitter almond hedge of the colony, where we could leave messages for each other. Saba knew of this post, for I showed it to him on the night I returned to fetch my sister. It is a long throw of the dice, but Saba may still visit it to find a message from me."
"I will think on these things you have told me," Hal said. And Daniel, lying near him in the dark cell, heard the power and authority in his voice and shook his head.
"Ah, it is the voice and the manner of Captain Frankie he has now," Daniel marvelled. "What the Dutchies are doing to him here might have put a lesser man up on the reef, but by God, all they've done to him is filled his mainsail with a strong wind." Hal had taken over his father's role, and the crew who had survived recognized it. More and more, they looked to him for leadership, to
to give them courage to go on and to counsel them, to settle the petty disputes that rose almost daily between men in such bitter straits, and to keep a spark of hope and courage burning in all their hearts. The next evening, Hal took up the council of war that exhaustion had interrupted the night before. "So Sukina knows where to leave a message for Saba?" "Naturally, she knows it well. The hollow tree on the banks of the Irsta River, the first river beyond the boundary hedge," Althuda replied. "Abeli must try to make contact with Saba. Is there something that is known only to you and Saba that will prove to him the message comes from you and is not a Dutch trap?" Althuda thought about this. "Just say, 'Tis the father of little Bobby,'" he suggested at last. Hal waited in silence for Althuda to explain, and after a pause he went on. "Robert is my son, born in the wilderness after we had escaped from the colony. This August he will be a year old. His mother is one of the girls I spoke of. In all but name she is my wife. Nobody inside the bitter almond hedge but I could know the child's name."
"So you have as good a reason as any of us for wanting to fly over these walls," Hal murmured.
The content of the messages that they were able to pass to Abeli was severely restricted by the size of the paper they could safely employ without alerting the jailers or the sharp, hungry scrutiny of Hugo Bernard. Hal and Althuda spent hours straining their eyes in the dim light and flogging their wits to compose the most succinct messages that would still be intelligible. The replies that returned to them were the voice of Sukina speaking, little jewels of brevity that delighted them with occasional flashes of wit and humour. Hal found himself thinking more and more of Sukina, and when she came again to the castle, following behind her mistress, her eyes went first to the scaffold where he worked, before going on to seek out her brother. Occasionally, when there was space in the letters that Abeli placed in the crack of the wall, she made little personal comments, a reference to his bushing black beard or the passing of his birthday. This startled Hal and touched him deeply. He wondered for a while how she had known this intimate detail until he guessed that Abeli had told her. He encouraged Althuda to talk about her in the darkness. He learned little things about her childhood, her fancies and her dislikes. As he lay and listened to Althuda, he began to fall in love with her. Now, when Hal looked to the mountains in the north, they were covered by a mantle of snow that shone in the wintry sunlight. The wind came down from it like a lance and seemed to pierce his soul. Abeli has still not heard from Saba. After 4 months of waiting, Hal at last accepted that failure. "We will have to cut him out of our plans. He is my friend, but he must have given me up," Althuda agreed. "I grieve for my wife, for she also must be mourning my death." "Let us move on, then, for it boots us not to wish for what is denied us," Hal said firmly. "It would be easier to escape from the quarry on the mountain than from the castle itself. It seems that Sukina must have arranged for your reprieve. Perhaps in the same fashion she can have us sent to the quarry." They dispatched the message, and a week later the reply came back. Sukina was unable to influence the choice of their workplace, and she cautioned that any attempt to do so would arouse immediate suspicion. "Be patient, Gondwani," she told him in a longer message than she had ever sent before. "Those who love you are working for your salvation." Hal read that message 100 times, then repeated it to himself as often. He was touched that she should also use his nickname, Gondwani. Of course, Abeli had told her that also. "Those who love you." Does she mean Abeli alone, or does she use the plural intentionally? "Is there another who loves me too? Does she mean me alone, or does she include Althuda, her brother?" He alternated between hope and dismay. "How can she trouble my mind so, when I have never even heard her voice? How can she feel anything for me, when she sees nothing but a bearded scarecrow in a beggar's rags? But then perhaps Abeli has been my champion, and told her I was not always thus." Plan as they would, the days passed and hope grew threadbare. 6 more of Hal's seamen died during the months of August and September. 2 fell from the scaffold, 1 was struck down by a falling block of masonry, and 2 more succumbed to the cold and the damp. The 6th was Oliver, who had been Sir Francis's manservant. Early in their imprisonment, his right foot had been crushed beneath the iron-shod wheel of one of the ox wagons that brought the stone down from the quarry. Even though Dr. Saar had placed a splint upon the shattered bone, the foot would not mend. It swelled up and burst out in suppurating ulcers that smelt like the flesh of a corpse. Hugo Bernard drove him back to work, even though he limped around the courtyard on a crude crutch. Hal and Daniel tried to shield Oliver, but if they intervened too obviously, Bernard became even more vindictive. All they could do was take as much of the work as they could on themselves and keep Oliver out of range of the overseer's whip. When the day came that Oliver was too weak to climb the ladder to the top of the south wall, Bernard sent him to work as a mason's boy, trimming and shaping the slabs of stone. In the courtyard, he was right under Bernard's eye, and twice in the same morning, Bernard laid into him with the whip. The last was a casual blow, not nearly as vicious as many that had preceded it. Oliver was a tailor by trade, and by nature a timid and gentle creature. But like a cur driven into an alley from which there was no escape, he turned and snapped. He swung the heavy wooden mallet in his right hand, and though Bernard sprang back, he was not swift enough, and it caught him across one shin. It was a glancing blow that did not break bone, but it smeared the skin, and a flush of blood darkened Bernard's hose and seeped down into his shoe. Even from his perch on the scaffold, Hal could see by his expression that Oliver was appalled and terrified by what he'd done. "Sir," he cried, and fell to his knees. "I did not mean it. Please, sir, forgive me." He dropped the mallet and held up both hands to his face in the attitude of prayer.